Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I ain't got time to waste.
Listen.
Devontae, Lightyear, Sugar Steve, Raphael.
You know what it is.
Let's go.
Forgetting the...
Rapid fire.
I got too many questions to even start with a seven-minute tribute. You already know you're the man, Raphael.
Word.
Okay. I'll start with... Okay. Of course, I believe I knew that you were born in Oakland. I don't know, but tell me. Where were you born?
I was actually born in Oakland, California. Right in East Oakland, Highland Hospital. So I'm born and raised. The rest of my family's from like Louisiana, from Monroe, Louisiana, Sweetport, Louisiana. And I'm the only out of 14. I'm the only city slicker that was born in the city.
Wait, you have 13 other siblings?
What? Yeah.
Are you you're the baby?
A baby boy. But wow. I have a sister that's younger than me.
What is that like in the household?
Well, everybody was in the household. It was a little bit of
your dad.
I should.
A little bit of that, but we were like my father has some kids before he married my mom. Before he's okay. with my mom.
Right.
And then you know my brother Dwayne, he had a different mother. So me and Dwayne have different mothers.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Blended family. I get that.
Yeah. There you go.
Is the entire family musically inclined or just you and Dwayne?
No, it's a few of us. My brother Randy is you probably heard him sing on a record called Holy Smokes and Gee Whiz.
Yes, yes. Holy mm-hmm. Smokes and Gee Whiz.
Yes, indeed.
That's the real talent in the family. We were all like an afterthought when it came to music. We just kind of snuck in there a little bit.
Where does Randy fall into the brood? Like
he's like the fourth from the oldest. He's like, and we had another brother named Alvy Wiggins who's he's singing country music. Charlie Pride was his favorite singer. So he was a country singer, but he was a street thug though. He was a real hardcore. He was not no thug. He was a classy like gangster. You know what I mean? But he's singing country music.
A gangster with a heart of gold.
Yeah.
This explains a lot of your. Well, wait. Where does Dwayne fall in line with you? I'm. Assuming
Dwayne's,
that you were close.
Dwayne is out. I had another brother in between me and Dwayne named Desmond. Desmond was a drummer in the family, and Desmond passed away when I was 17 years old. And Dwayne is older than him, a couple years older than Desmond.
Okay.
So Dwayne would be like the sixth youngest boy.
Okay. Man.
It's confusing. Actually, when I start thinking about it like that, I'm like totally confused.
Okay. So I know Thanksgiving and Christmas must have been hella crazy.
Yeah, it was actually good because, you know, it was just a lot of music in the house and a lot of Teddy, you know, my stepmom loved Teddy Pendergrass and Isley Brothers. So that's where our guitar stuff comes from because we get to stay outside as long as we could if they was having a little party. But in the house, it'd be Teddy Pendergrass and it'd be Isley Brothers. So this is the first time I got a chance to say shit was on Fight the Power. Fun to parents, you know?
what is your actual first musical memory that you acknowledge?
I think for me, I was like a kid who had, you know, you had to be outside playing with individuals and your friends, some of my really great friends. And but I think mine was when I first got my first bass amplifier. I had this Univox. I had a copy Fender Jazz called the Orlando, and I opened up the case and I thought it was real fur. Thought I was rich because I had this bass guitar. This fur inside of it. And that was my first musical experience, really. And then I played first trombone and jazz band too. So I wanted to play saxophone, but they didn't have any more.
What age is this again?
This is in grade school. Well, grade school, I was just starting to play, but by the time I got to high school, I sat in first chair playing trombone.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, what is it like to grow up in Oakland, kind of watching, you know, at least from my point of view, you know, the legend of Oakland is is Sly and the Family Stone and Graham Central Station and Tower Power and all these like powerful musicians that are making like, you know, they're international stars. Like, what kind of impression is that leaving on you?
Well, for me, it was everything, because we're basically Larry Graham was more of the idol for me, because I'm a bass player, right?
But bassist, yeah.
Right. So, you know, like one block you would have, you know, a band playing, and it was a band in every garage. Everywhere we looked, it was like Natalie Cole had a band that was played in Oakland. So when they were off and not touring, they would be playing in the garage. So Willie Wilde, who played with Graham Central Station, and we would see, like, you know, Larry Graham and, you know, riding through the neighborhood on a Harley Davidson. Him and Sly, that was their thing, riding like Harleys and like the choppers, the short choppers. And so they were like our comic books characters for us, just because that's all we knew. It was almost like a, like MCs, like rappers. It was like battle the bands. It was battle rappers, battle of the bands, battle bass players. If you couldn't play like the Jam or the song called Pow on the bass.
Oh, Pow, I got you. That was a hit in Oakland.
That's a hit.
With wow. Going to the country and going to Rock Moth, like the
I got you. But you get your folks wrong. I mean, everybody in our neighborhood, could play bass, or guitar, or drums. So when I was about 10 or 11, you would walk into a garage and a band was playing. Somebody would say, "Hey, my little brother could play bass." So you couldn't really get on a bass unless you knew how to play Pow, because somebody was gonna test you out. They were gonna
say, "Can't take it right now, yo."
They was gonna say, "Can you play Pow?" And then you have to do like this, like, yeah. And as soon as you say yes, they only give you 2 seconds before the drummer just kick it off.
Wait a minute. This is how I know you are a special individual. Literally last week, the Roots like did our first run in like 18 months. And so I don't know how, but I think one of them songs from Star Walk came on. I think it was Sneaky Freak. And my band was asking me about it. And the way I was putting it to them was, I was like, I don't know how to accurately judge Larry Graham's canon, because I know, like, hit-wise, you know, the first three Graham Central Station albums were, like, national hits, like, up until Ain't No Bout to Doubt It. But somehow it got a little weird around. Mirror was, like, a hit. I remember that being a hit when I was a kid. But it's something about Now Do You Want to Dance? And My Radio Sounds Good to Me, and the Star Walk albums that didn't have hits on them, but from Prince to every musician I know, they swear by those three records. And we were watching Graham Central Station do Pow last week, and we were kind of, I was laughing, because I was like, I know this is good, but it wasn't a hit. So I'm trying to figure out, like, am I the only one that got this song? And you mentioned, so you're saying to me, In Oakland, that song is a rite of passage.
To everybody. I mean, you could walk up to a guy in Oakland, and I have a friend named Lornell, and I didn't know this. And he just, one day, he asked me what I know about Larry Graham. And I'm like, looking at him like, what this dude know? This dude, he's a security guy at San Quentin Prison. That's all I know about him. He just goes, "Top of the Smoky Mama." And I'm like, what? So in Oakland, Larry's bigger than Sly.
I know.
Wow.
Wow.
So that's like cool. Larry is like when I was a kid, I was going on a snow trip in Tahoe, and I went to buy some mittens, like 10 or 11, and I was walking to a store called Long's Drugs. It's in San Leandro. And I walk in the store, I walk in this grocery store, and Larry Graham and Chocolate is getting out of a black Thunderbird suicide doors with the wig on, with the album Release, How They Looked and Release Yourself, when they're in the air, jumping up, suspending in there. And I'm like, is that Larry Graham? Wow. So I start following him around the grocery store, looking through boxes and everything. So before he walks out, I run out and sit at the bus stop right in front of the store, but I'm not looking back at him. I'm just looking at the street. So Larry and Chocolate walk up to me in front of the bus stop and look dead at me and go, how you doing? And I'm like freaking out. Like, it's like a Star Wars moment for me.
Oh,
I said, and I go like, and I go, are you Larry Graham? He like, yeah, I'm Larry Graham. This is Chocolate. And I was like freaking out, bro. So yeah, he was like a superhero to us. But Powell, but yeah, to answer your question, Powell, The Jam, David Dynamite, Butch.
What about Earthquake?
Earthquake, of course. I mean, Hair, Earthquake.
They were trying to destroy their base with the towel and all that stuff that he...
And if you listen to Today, the song Today, right?
Yeah.
So we used to sit in a room as kids and just sit by the turntable and wait for that bell to go off. Every time we let somebody hear that song, we would never let them leave for the first time until the bell rings all the way out.
Yo,
so when I let D'Angelo hear Today for the first time, I made D'Angelo listen to it till the bell went all the way off.
Really?
Because that's how we kind of grew up. Everybody had to listen to the bell the first time.
Dog.
Which rang for like, what, 3 minutes?
That's what I was going to ask you. I was like, so did the bell ring? For those who don't know about the song, are you saying you got to listen to a bell for 3 minutes? Okay.
Oh, man. Seven. You know what? Yeah, I'm also hating that I'm having this conversation because I think I was ready to just dismiss it. Because one of the playlists that I have on my Spotify is called Songs in E minor and Songs in E minor that I hate. And for I know for bass players, like E minor is like a rite of passage key, but for me it's like unless you're trying to top The Jam or Shining Star, or Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself, like, or a song like Glide, like, I almost feel like that's such a taboo key for bass players, but yet, like, the amount of songs that I hear people trying to attempt to hop that, jump that cliff, that Thelma and Louise cliff, and they never make it, now you got me, like, now I got to go back and reconsider that just because it means something in Oakland.
That's very true. I mean, I don't think I've ever wrote a song that was worth anything in E minor.
I was going to say, for Cat from Oakland, I don't think is that even on purpose? Like,
I heard through the grapevine that, you know, through one of my friends, she has a podcast with Most Def's mom, and Erica Connor and she spoke to your mom, I think.
Yes.
And they said your mom said you had perfect pitch as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
So I only have perfect pitch for E natural because of Larry Graham.
Wow.
Anything past that, I'm done. You tell me, because I played every Graham song in E, I could just down. I know where it's at.
Yeah, I mean, I base all my things on whatever the song is, you know. Like, if you say B minor, I just instantly think Don't Stop to Get Enough. If you say
that's
G, it's also based on the Prince of the Michael Jackson song. If you say G, I'm like, oh, that's Shake Your Body Down to the Ground. So it's not,
I get it.
And even as
I spoke to Billy Graham one time. I was hanging outside of the Oakland Coliseum. Edition concert.
I thought you meant Reverend Billy Graham. I'm like, what?
No, Bill Graham, the concert promoter.
The promoter.
Okay. Proponer, yeah. The promoter.
Mm-hmm.
He saw me trying to sneak in this concert. He let me in the concert, and he said, are you a musician? I said, yes. And he says, what do you play? I said, I play bass. Who's your favorite musician? I said, Larry Graham. He said, Larry would be much better if he stopped making battle records. And so, and by him saying that, who knew I was going to be ever making records? I didn't know. I never tried to be a singer or anything. I just wanted to play in a band. I never wanted to be a singer. I never wanted to be a lead singer. I just wanted to play for a band and work at a record store. That was probably it. And but once he said that and I started making music, it always stayed in my head. Never try to be a battle band, try to make records.
That makes sense. Because even his songs were about how good of a band we are, and you'll never get to this level of perfection that I'm in.
BTS, the baddest group from east to west.
Raphael, what was it like the first time you got Larry Graham's ear for real? Like when he
So when I first got his ear, I was at Eddie Murphy's house and he was hanging out with Eddie Murphy and I'm like, wow. So he was just in the garage.
Player. Right.
Yeah, he was hanging out in this garage. It was just me and him in the garage. And I was like, okay, when am I gonna break this to this dude that I've been like damn near
stalking him
my whole right. life? And I'm like, cause we talking on some, we just real cool. And I was just like, forget it. Here we go. We're sitting in the garage next to some jet skis. I said, hey man, I grew up in Oakland. I was in a band with your son, Derek Graham, in my high school band. He was like, really? I said, yeah, man, I play bass. So I didn't have a bass on me. I had an acoustic. Right. So I tried to play something on acoustic that was his, and it just didn't work.
Wait a minute. And, time out. Tony didn't mean anything to him at the time?
I think he knew about the Tonys, but he didn't know that I played bass.
Okay, right. I get it.
Remember,
okay.
nobody thought I played bass. Yeah. Everybody thought I was like, you know.
The singer.
The dancer,
right.
Yeah.
You know, nobody knew that. I was only made to play bass because when we first came out, there were no bands out, and everybody wanted us to be like, you know, we had to compete with Guy, and everybody was out, so I had to put the bass down, and it had to become this other thing. So nobody really knew me for playing bass, which I felt like Linus and Charlie Brown, like I put down my security blanket.
Right.
Wow. Which was my bass that made me feel very manly and tough and made me feel all these different things. So when I put it down and became and had to sing, I wasn't really confident about singing. So he would have no way of knowing that I was a bass player, even though I played all the records on the bass, on bass on the Tony's album.
Wow. And so you didn't get to prove yourself.
I finally got Graham in my studio.
Okay.
In Blakesley. And he came over and I got on the bass and I completely cannot play bass in front of Graham.
Wow.
It hasn't worked yet. Every time I tried to play, I was like, bro, for some reason, it's just not working right now. So I just left it alone. But when he leaves, I'm like, all
over.
You're
killing it.
Yeah.
Killing it.
You got mind control over Larry Graham.
Yeah, when I can kill him.
I stopped talking. But when he leaves,
yeah, we played on the album. He played on my album like 2 albums ago. We did a song together.
Yeah.
It's a hidden track. And I play guitar, and Rob Bacon play guitar, and he played bass. And he played right in front of me, and I was just sitting there. I was playing guitar like, this is crazy.
And still you ain't playing bass in front of him. Damn.
Wow.
I think I sat in front of Sly and George Clinton maybe 2 times. And this is weird. Every time I get around Sly, it's weird, too. I kind of just stare at Sly, and I have to leave. Because I'm like, this dude is like Sly, right?
Oh, I'm so comforted by this.
I just kind of walked out, and George says, George told Sly, he said, yeah, boy. He said, that's the answer to you right here in Oakland. It's me. He said that's about me. And I was sitting there looking at him because I'm friends with his daughter. And I was like, all this greatness in the room, George and Sly, they was actually sitting in a mobile home in front of Eddie Murphy's house for 2 hours. And so Eddie goes, who is that in that mobile home? And I goes, there ain't nobody but Sly and George. And Eddie started laughing, but I knew it was them. They just sat in the mobile home for 2 hours before they walked in.
what was they doing?
Who knows?
You know what they was doing.
Wait, time out. What year was this?
This is no longer than, this is maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Oh,
okay,
maybe
they
less.
Was chilling. They was chilling.
Okay,
chilling.
It's, yeah.
Was George was kind of getting his joint together.
Yeah, yeah, he together.
Yeah. Man, I can stay on this for hours. We got to push a little bit.
Yeah.
Before you started the group, I know that you cut your teeth playing with bands. And I know that, I knew of you because of your association with Sheila, but what acts were you playing with? Was Sheila like the first national act that you got to, and how did that situation happen? Was there anyone before that?
No, really, before that, I was playing locally. I really started the Tonys. I played a lot of local bands, and I played for the Hawkins family a bit.
Played with Joel Smith.
Like gospel?
Yeah. Joel Smith was sort of my idol bass player. He passed away. One of the best bass players in the world. and drummers, and besides you, you're probably my one of my best favorite bass and drummers. I tell everybody, I say, one thing about Quest, no bass player can hate on Quest. If you play bass, you should just murder him. Because the foot, the kick drum and the snare and the hi-hat is like what I used to look for as a kid. I would knock on, if I hear a drummer in a house, I would knock on the door and say, hey man, I play bass. That's how I grew up. So wow. Yeah, I started playing with the Hawkins family. I played with Annette Hawkins. I played with Shirley Miller. I played with Vanessa Bell Armstrong. And then I started playing with Sheila in 86. I auditioned. Levi Caesar got me the gig. He called me and said, you know, you want to audition for Sheila E. in 86. I auditioned, and we went on a Under Cherry Moon tour in Japan. And Wendy and Lisa was still playing with Prince.
You were there the night he destroyed his guitar?
Where?
In Japan. Well, the way that he fired the revolution after Purple Rain, it finally made the internet. It's the clip is on the internet, but there's a moment where Wendy and Lisa say they knew the band was over. He took the cloud guitar and destroyed it on stage, walked off stage, came back, did another solo, and then destroyed that cloud guitar. And then Wendy and Lisa and Bobby looked at each other and was like, yeah, it's over. Yeah,
it's Rap City.
It was over. So yeah, you were there that
it was
whole
pretty
time?
It was pretty much over on that tour, but you know, like I said, I was like 18 years old.
Right.
So I just had a good time hanging out with like Cubby was a sound guy. Yeah. Brown Mark, I used to get play out of his rig, and because the band was breaking up, Prince would use us to play all the after gigs. So I would play You Need Another Lover, the whole album.
Wow.
Every club, Prince would call us to play instead of them.
Is that why one of our listeners asked me to ask you about the opportunity to be in Prince's band? Was it from then?
Well, I was going to be the original band for Madhouse, the group called Madhouse.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. This jazz joint.
Okay.
Right. Really? He wants to be in a band called Madhouse. But when we heard the band was going to be wearing like masks over their face, which could have been dope, we had already sort of formed, because at the time it was me and Tim Riley, who played with the Tonys. He was the drummer. Right. And I got the gig first, and then Sheila was like, don't bring back a drummer. I brought Tim back anyway. He auditioned, and my friend Carl Wheeler, he played keyboards, and all three of us went. We rehearsed for like 2 months, 15 hours a day. Prince hired us to play for it because he was paying the bills, basically. Mm-hmm. And I would sing his parts in Erotic City. He would say stuff to me. The first time he walked up to us, he walked up to us with a yellow suit on and a cane. And he walks up and he goes, what's your name? And, you know, everybody said his name. And then he goes, hi, I'm Prince. We're looking like, no shit. I mean, we're in the middle of this stadium, like all this sound. I've never heard this much power before. Because when we came out, it was like, when he came out, he would come out around the world in a day. And the curtains would
that
just
would be his
drop.
Opening song? That was his opening song for the set?
Yeah. And so I was sitting in the... I would sit in the baseball dugout, which is a folded, cabinet of it, so you could hear all the bass. And I would just say the Revolution was the best band he ever had. Except, you know, I wish if Des Dickerson, Des would have been there.
Yeah.
Wow. That was it. That was pretty much it. From school, high school, I played in jazz band. I played for choirs. I played gospel. I played funk. I played every club. There was, and then right off the back, it was Prince and Sheila.
Okay, well, look, I feel
he
like
was ready.
This is probably the only time I'm going to get the opportunity to ask you, and you know I'm a Prince head, but you already mentioned the Hawkins family, and I just literally, like, what is that circuit like? Like that whole gospel circuit in the Hawkins, was it Walter or Edwin that you were?
It was Walter. At this time, it was more Walter, but Edwin is the pioneer who, you know, kind of produced the new version of Oh Happy Days, because that's really an old song, but he actually reproduced it his way. But honestly, playing for like the Hawkins family for us was that's equivalent to like Tower Power in Oakland. You know, we had Tower Power, and then we had the Hawkins family, and they were the whole circuit. They were the whole gamut. If you want to play gospel, that was the biggest it got. Besides, you know, if you go down a little south, you got Andre Crouch.
Did you play with Crouch at all?
No, no, just think my I'm a huge fan, and I listen to him like every week. I listen to Andre Crouch.
Wow.
But it's a big circuit. It was great music every Sunday morning, every week. Right next door to my high school was Love Center's first church where they recorded like Follow Me and all these records. So
right.
we would go to lunch and we would listen to Joel Smith and Johnson DeBose rehearse at lunchtime.
What?
Yeah.
How was the money?
Crazy. This is crazy.
How's gospel money? Wow. How's gospel money as a teenager in a band? How's the gospel money?
Man, let me tell you something. I've never worried about no money in the music industry till now.
Wait, what now? I don't understand what you're saying. I don't understand.
That's how much I love music. I've made money being an artist now, but I play so many gigs because I love music. You know, whatever money I got. In Oakland, hey, man, if you wasn't getting murdered or killed, when you wake up, everything else is extra.
Right.
if somebody was calling me for $100, our sound man used to cost, the Tonys, our sound man used to cost us $150, and we was making $150 playing the clubs. It just got rid of the idle time that we didn't need to be hanging out in the street, because we're pretty much just not no band dudes. If you're in Oakland, you got to do Oakland things until you get done with doing Oakland things.
Let me ask, okay, since Too Short was on the show and he kind of outed himself as a nerd disguised as a gangster.
paraphrase.
How did you... Because I'm thinking that life chooses you. Like, you don't have a choice to say, I'm not going to do that or I will do that, because I feel like that life chooses you. Like, you don't have a choice but to walk past this corner and past this group and either get jumped in or beat down or whatever. Like, how did you avoid what I know to be Oakland? Because Oakland is probably one of the craziest. I mean, the Bay Area in general, especially when we first started going there, like in the 90s. So I know that in the 80s and in the 70s. I mean, you're forever going to look 36. So I don't know how old you are, but I know it's way older than 36. Although you look 26, like.
Old as hell.
What was it?
You look good as hell, too. So it don't matter.
I avoided because, you know, like. I have a lot of family from Chicago, a lot of family in Chicago and the South Side and the West Side. And you know, your parents are on the phone, you're hearing about everything that's happened to your family. And also with all those brothers and sisters, I lost three brothers and sisters. Mm. One of my brothers committed suicide. One of my brothers, Alvy, was murdered. And my other sister got hit by a car from some cop running from a kid running from a cop in his car who killed my sister, had permanent brain damage. And when you see trauma like that, you know, and my father would say to me all the time, he was like, if you see somebody, my brother killed himself because he couldn't get off dope. So my father would say, if you see somebody shooting a gun in rapid fire, what you going to do? At this point, I was so young, I didn't even know what rapid meant. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to turn around and go the other way. That's what I'm talking about. He was just so frustrated. And he also said, if, you know, when you go to jail, it's a very difficult thing down there. It's a system that's hard to understand. And, you know, so I do know one thing, they give you one phone call. So if you go to jail, I think you should call somebody to understand that system, because I don't know anything about it. And that's what kept me.
I was just about to ask you.
I'm not coming for you.
I'm not coming for you. And my father was the only one to carry a pocket full of money, a wad full of money. So with that and how much I love music, I'll say that, you know, instrumentation, musicians like Earth, Wind, and Fire, and, you know, even like the Mamas and the Papas, all the music I used to hear in Berkeley and San Francisco and the hippie stuff that I used to hear and all the gospel, it really saved my life. So when I run into people like, rest in peace, like Maurice White, and I see Verdine and those guys, I just tell them, you basically saved my life by making great music, because it kept me in my room making music. But on the other side, I felt like my life was like the narration of the movie City of Gods.
Whoa.
Like, I was the kid with the camera.
Yeah.
Like, chicken that escaped. I had a moped and I would ride around Oakland. I would witness murders because I was everywhere. I would see stuff, but I would keep going. And I would be listening to, in my headphones, and my Sony Walkman with a cassette, I'll be listening to Ronnie Run to Russia. Ronnie Run to Russia before it's too late.
Right, right.
You know, but that nobody knew what I'd be listening to. And so between the hood of everybody listening to Knee Deep and Funkadelic and everything, my neighborhood was listening. My neighborhood was big on Funkadelic.
Right.
So I think the music sort of, like you said, the street is the street. The streets could be your father and your mother. But my father was my father. My mother was my mother. And music was like my godparents.
Can I ask the word? Because I know most parents I know will sort of drift towards safety more than pursuing a dream. So assuming that, you know, that you were passionate about your musical pursuits, were your parents in like encouraging and nurturing on that end, or were they just like, nah, boy, like go to post office, get a job?
Oh, learn no, computers. None of that. Like my mother was like, get you 50 years in over here at the Highland Hospital, and when you're my age, you can retire. my father was a little bit, my father could play guitar a little bit. He could sing. My dad kind of sing like Sam Cooke. But my dad was just like, I used to work at United Parcel for a minute. I had all kind of like, I had jobs. I was doing landscaping. It wasn't another, like, you couldn't be in my house and tell somebody you're going to be a star and leave me alone. That shit was not going to fly. So I think my father told me, when I told him I got this gig, he just told me, he said, hey, if you want to, if you, because everybody was saying, you know, church people, you're going to hell because you're playing R&B. And my dad would say, son, the church key of G is the same key as R&B, the same key of G. If you don't, if you want to, if that scares you, I got some work for you at the Naval Air. You know, you can come and work here. But other than that, I think I got a job playing this gig at this club called Lucky Lion with this band. And I told my father, because I bust my fingers at UPS. I bust three of my fingers on the conveyor belt and my nails came right off.
Oh.
So I quit because I didn't want to, you know, they had these safety working days. And if you ring the bell, you mess up the whole staff's safety working days. I tried to hold it for a minute, but when the nails came out, blah, hit the alarm, called my dad and said, I got this gig. I want to do this gig club. And my dad said, well, don't tell your mom. Do not tell your mother. If you need some money, call me. And I never had to call him because I had those little $150 gigs. But my mother didn't find out that I quit that job until she saw me on the Tonys on Arsenio Hall.
Wow.
Yo, I am not alone in
And what did
this
she say?
World. Nice.
She didn't, my mother didn't know I could sing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
She saw me kind of sing around. I mean, but nobody knew I could sing. Nobody in my high school. Because I was singing at home, you know, mess around, but my mother didn't realize that I wasn't working at UPS until she turned to Arsenio and they was like, Tony, Tony, Tony. And I was all, you know, going for it.
Dog. Yo, man, you don't even know. Between your love of Pal and that story, no one believes me when I tell my dad, when I say that my dad didn't know about the Roots until our second album. They're like,
yeah,
how's that
basically, yeah.
Nah, you hide that shit, yo. Wow.
You
hide that. You can't. It's none of that. Come home to me. I got a dream. A what?
Wow.
Better get a
dream. A what? A dream. A what?
Yeah,
he
wanted my ass in college, and he wasn't having that. Like, just hang with that Tariq. No, you go to college, boy.
Right.
Saw that insurance.
That Tariq.
That Tariq.
That hoodlum. That hoodlum Tariq.
I believe
exactly.
He said it. I believe
that hoodlum Tariq. Hey, Ray. Around 85, 86, I know that, you know, Foster McElroy produced the first Tony record, but what was like the relationship? Did you guys have any run-ins with like J. King, the Club Nouveau, Click?
Club
like
Nouveau,
any of
yeah.
The... Yeah, I lived in Sacramento after I moved out of Oakland. I came back off the tour, my first tour after 88. My mom had moved to Sacramento. I came into my house and it said, we moved to Sacramento. And not a house I bought. My mom bought her own house. Everybody think I bought my mother house. It was in Jet Magazine. They're like, oh, he bought his mom house. My mom, like, he ain't buying no damn thing.
So wait, that night when you first saw the Roots in Sacramento, you were still living in your mom's house?
No, I had bought a house in Sacramento.
Oh, whew. Okay.
I followed her. I lived there the first couple of years. I wasn't buying nothing, bro. I had a Toyota Tradia.
Oh yeah,
that I bought from my sister. I wasn't buying nothing, bro. I was very frugal. I didn't believe the hype either. They scared me so much about being an artist. Mm-hmm. I never really bought into the whole artist thing, really. I kept a very low pro, but I wrote Just Me and You in my mother's in my room in my mother's house on an MP and a T3 Accord. I wrote that in my room.
Wow.
Yeah, so yeah, I did run into J. King a lot, Club Nouveau, because he actually spun off Denny and Tommy. And right. Denny and Tommy went on to get a production deal with Ed Eckstein over at Wing Mercury. Records, which he became Wing, president of Polygram. And
the son
after that,
of Billy Eckstein, right?
Son of Billy Eckstein. Ed Eckstein was our Clive Davis.
Mm-hmm. No, he was.
And after that, we never had one since. I've been pretty much on my own. I never had to go to it. I had no connect after that. After that, I was just connecting with artists and just kind of just doing myself. But Denny and Tommy was definitely the ones who spun us into making songs, because we had just left Prince, and I don't know what happened to us right after that. I don't think we had any, we didn't have any producer skills or any like.
Oh, so like
we
the knew structure of it.
We knew structure, song structure, but we wasn't studying it. We would have came out trying to be probably Maserati or somebody if it wasn't for those two guys.
One, if Prince is offering you an opportunity to do something, and your mind is like, yo, we about to make it. Like, not how much courage did it take, but obviously you gave them a no. And at one point, like, was Paisley Park even trying to sign you guys?
It never got that far. I was just like, Sheila was going to fire us pretty soon because she was going on to play on the Signs of the Times tour.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Prince would get on the bus, and he would play Signs of the Times, the whole album, or he would see me in the club, and he was like, come over here, I want to play you something. And then we'll walk to the speaker, he would look at the DJ, and he'd be like, hold on. He like, put your head in the speaker. So both of us would put our head inside of a folded cabinet in like this, and then he'll point to the DJ, and then he'd play Housequake.
Oh.
And at that point, I knew Sheila was on her way, and we was on our way home. And then they put her road manager, Roy, I forgot his name at the time, they put McDonald applications in our bunks on the tour.
No. So circle back again.
What?
So circle back again. Tony, what was your circle back with Prince and Sheila?
Wait a minute. Y'all didn't appreciate that joke.
I did.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
I should have let it sit for a second. I'm sorry. I didn't know. I get in when I can fit in. Take the moment.
Oh, my God.
We woke up with Mickey D applications in our bunk.
Yeah.
Because that was it. And we were going home because he was playing all these hits, you know, Starfish and Coffee. Was like, damn. So he took Levi Caesar. He took Sheila and he took Bonnie Boy.
Bonnie.
Yeah, we were all in a band together with Sheila.
Dude, can you talk about, I know nothing about, like, Bonnie came from Oakland, correct?
Bonnie was from Oakland. She was funky. I mean, she would pick up my bass and show me some funk licks that I didn't know in E.
She could play bass?
Yeah, so her boyfriend growing up was in this band called Windstorm, right?
Okay.
Her boyfriend back in the day was Rusty Allen.
Rusty Allen? She dated Rusty Allen, Larry's replacement in Sly and the Family Stone?
So she knew all that bass stuff from him. So she used to show me licks that one day we're sitting down, I'll show you what she showed me. She took my bass in the back of the bus and just took my bass like, give me that. And just started like, hey. And I was like, damn. Like,
no.
So, yeah, Bonnie was, she was one of Oakland's greatest. She was a vocal coach. She was a keyboard player with Sheila. She doubled Sheila vocals on the tour.
Right.
If you listen to Kissing You that I produced for Puffy's group Toto.
Yeah.
That the backgrounds, that's her.
That's Bonnie Boyer?
That's Bonnie Boyer.
Wow. Did not
that
know that.
That's awesome. That's dope.
Yeah, so she was all that, man. So that experience.
Hey, one more quick question. I know that around 85, Wait, was Rosie from Oakland or was she from L.A.?
Rosie's, I don't know exactly where she's from, but she lived in Oakland. She, most of her life, she was like in Oakland.
Because I know she was in that circle as well and didn't come until the second draft with MVG. But I wanted to know if she made her rounds in the local.
Oh, she was like, she had like local gigs and everybody played with her. She had a, I mean, Prince pretty much adopted everybody out of Oakland from Miko Weaver to Sheila's first band.
Miko's from Oakland too?
Yeah, bro. Everybody. Eddie M.
Man.
Oh, that makes sense.
Everybody Prince used after the revolution was all Oakland based. Mostly. The next two bands, I would say.
Okay. That makes total sense.
Okay, so circle back now. After the McDonald's applications are on your bed, but you're grown, you're Raphael Sadiq, Tony. What's the first run-in with Prince and Sheila E. like now that you have proven yourself to the world?
That you own.
Yeah.
Well, I think the first one was when I wrote this song on my first album called Born Not to Know, and I wrote this line, said, for no reason, it's only because I'm a lazy songwriter, and I just wrote this lyric that said, things are getting crazy. I'm not wearing paisley because I was born not to know. So Prince must have heard that, invited me into a show in Hampton, Virginia on the Love Sexy Tour. And he asked me if I wanted to come on stage. And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I come on stage and he said, you want to come up and play basketball? So we just shooting basketball on the court. We shooting around. And then he goes, then he gets the mic and he goes, here's a little boy who made the paisley rhyme. And I'm like, damn, he heard that. And so...
Wait, so Fonte looks a little confused
little
right
boy.
Now.
Wait,
little boy, that's where I was, Fonte.
Fonte,
boy.
Yeah, that, yeah.
He, just to put in perspective.
I was a little boy now, but to him, here's a little boy who makes the paisley rhyme. I mean, I'm like,
wow.
So he gives me the microphone. He leaves me on the stage. Now, this is packed. And I'm like, well, I've got a couple of band members up there. I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like, you know, so I start singing Hey, Lil' Walter. And the crowd, and Sheila's on drums, Bonnie and everybody. And at this time... Prince hadn't, from what I heard, Prince never really invited people on the stage for that. Right. No Lenny, nobody. And he invited me on the stage. And so everybody in the band that knew me, they was all crying. I'm like, why are they crying? Because they were saying because he was being so nice to me. But he always been really, really, really nice to me. He always like invited me out to dinner in Japan. You want to go? You want to get something to eat? You want to go do this? You need some girls? You need some models? He was always like that to me. It was weird because another thing about Prince is when I was going to be in Madhouse, he told Levi to tell me to go listen to the Chamber Brothers. Right. I never heard of the Chamber Brothers. So when I got back home off the tour, after I decided not to go back with Prince, like the Prince thing never came to fruition like people thought. Right. But I remember him saying I should listen to the Chamber Brothers. So I went to this place called Leopold's in Berkeley and I bought every Chamber Brothers album there was. And when I listened to it, they had a song called the spiritual, Negro spiritual, called Wade in the Water.
Okay.
And they, it was so dark how they did it. And my first single ever with the Tonys was Hey Little Walter.
Yeah. Walter, you messed us up with that. So Prince was kind of,
right. So Prince was like kind of responsible for giving me a little light on that, which became the Tonys' first ever single, hit song. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And Sinbad's first video appearance.
That's true.
Right. Wait, I just wanted to put it in perspective because Fonte looked a little confused. Yeah, the way that the Love Sexy Tour was set up was Prince also had a basketball court on the stage.
On stage.
It was the show was in the round. I mean, like his last rounds of shows were. So it was like an elaborate, it was probably his most expensive setup. So
yeah. That's true.
Yeah,
that's
right. Wait, that's speaking of which, speaking of who, the song 2-6 to 1.5. Especially the pre-internet. Whose idea was that?
Wasn't mine.
Was that your brother? All right, first of all, can you explain, because I feel like the songs that your brother produces sounds, the way that you guys work, like, Is there an alpha for the person that brings the song to the forefront, or does he just work on a song by himself and you work on a song by yourself and you just figure like, okay, well, here's our Tony album, or how does that work?
In the later albums, it was exactly what you said. And the other one, maybe the second album, the first album was mainly, you know, Denny and Tommy and us. But right. The first single, like Little Walter, was just me, Denny and Tommy. Those guys, we got our first song, our deal. They didn't even show up to the studio at all. And so for the song or so. But Dwayne will come up with songs at home. He will he'll come and then we'll get together and figure them out. But he'll come up with a title like 261.5. That's actually a penal code for messing with underage.
For statutory rape.
Yes,
statutory rape.
You knew that.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah, yeah. You're the only one out of everybody we know who knows that.
I had to ask because that's such
a. You know what? We were seeing. How would he know that?
Should I ask that? I didn't mean to. How would one even know that?
Yes.
I think he was, at the time, he had dated a younger lady. He was his friend. And I think her auntie was an attorney.
Ah.
Okay. But she was pretty much a fast ass, one of those fast ass little girls who was like, you know, smart, though, really smart, and was just like, you know, this is like a 261.5. And so Dwayne was like, oh, that's a song. It.
Right.
And so he wrote a song about it, and we sort of took it from that. People, let me tell you about my best friend. He's a wonderful person who love. And I always loved that show as a kid. So I added that part to the vamp of the song. And that's Dwayne. Answer your question.
Yeah, I was going to say, in an interview, you guys once described yourself. You said that you were 70% yourselves, 20% the time, and then 10% the monkeys. Which,
wow.
That was Dwayne. I had nothing to do with any of that.
The monkeys.
No, but... The thing is, though, I mean, I understood the monkeys reference. Okay. Mind you, he said it on Soul Train, so, like, that would have thrown everyone off. But I got it that you guys, like, humor, the time definitely showed that humor goes a long way.
We was none of that. If I could just say who we were.
Okay.
I would say we were, like, everything that Oakland gave us, and we were a bit of trying to be like an Earth, Wind & Fire and the Commodores. And like my brother used to sing like this song called Hello Sunshine. Hello Sunshine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Dwayne was more like the Peebo Bryson who played guitar. We were a little bit of the Isley Brothers, a little bit of Earth, Wind & Fire and the Commodores, and we were like a funk band. We were more like a Brick.
Okay.
I think that's who we were. I think Dwayne would say things that he thought sounded great on TV. I mean.
Well, see, I fell for a hook, line, and sinker because you guys were funny. You guys showed humor in like your pop culture references and all that stuff that
Tony's
I instantly
in the wrong
got.
Key, shit like that.
Tony's in the wrong key, yeah.
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 I mean, but for me, I was always trying to be, honestly, for me, I was only trying to, I was more of a hip hop, East Coast hip hop head.
Right.
So
right.
I was always trying to find out why was those drums so dirty in hip hop and our drums were so clean. So my whole quest was to find out how to get dirty drums on my music. And how I found out was I sang out with Ice Cube on our first tour. And cause we toured NWA.
Right.
Cause there were no other bands.
Like,
It was crazy because there were no other bands, and I think they needed us on the tour because it was for insurance reasons.
Yeah, to make it legit.
It wasn't, you know, we had to get out, and it was for insurance reasons. Nobody told me that. I had to figure that out. But anyway, I was hanging out with Ice Cube, and he told me that the reason why drums sound like that is it's called break beats, and you could get these records from like 45 Kings. From the swap meet. So I went to the swap meet and I bought every break beat. And that's when I started hearing the meters. And that's the music I really love.
Right.
And then hip hop was like Tribe and everybody was sampling Sly and the songs that I like. And I was like, that's what I'm going to get into, was more of that. And then I tried to marry the both.
So what was project that came after that, after you had that conversation with Ice Cube and you went out and bought all that stuff? What was the Tony project?
It was good.
Revival.
It was good.
Oh, okay.
So, no, Revival. I was going to say, what lessons did you learn, assuming that you guys took the lead on it, what lessons did you learn on Revival that you didn't know on the Who record? And how did you break to Denny and Tommy? Because, I mean, the Who record was a hit. I mean, you guys had three hits on it. So what's the, like, are you talking to Ed Eckstein saying, like, look, I think we could do this on our own. Let us.
I think we just said that we wanted to do it on our own. I don't know if we knew what the hell we were doing at all. We were definitely, you know, I give kudos to Ed because he let us actually do it. But right. we've never had an A&R person nowhere near our rooms ever.
Okay.
We just spent too much money figuring it out on that second album. I think we rented a Sinclair for like $250,000 for the whole time. So we got ripped off on that. So that's what I learned. On how not to spend money on something you didn't really need.
That's the lesson you learned.
I was about to say, did y'all even use it on that album? Did y'all even use
the
Sinclair?
We used it on the whole album. That's why it sounds so clean.
Mm.
Like whatever you want. Like, it's like so, it sounds like crisp.
We just interviewed Pat Metheny, who also, like, you know, he's the...
Sinclair King?
Yes, exactly. So he was explaining, like, the early stages of that was, like, very expensive to operate. Yeah.
Hey, when we looked at the budget, and I was like, okay, we'll never do that again.
Hey, also, I know that you guys work with Keith Krautz on that album as well.
Keith played. This is a funny story. Keith played bass synthesizer on maybe one of the songs. He toured with us. Right. He played on Those Were the Days, I think.
Okay.
So me and Keith got into a little altercation over this girl, like when he was younger. It was funny. So right after he played on, so when I did Tony's in the Wrong Key, I introduced everybody who played with us. And he heard it. His name used to be on it. But when it got to his name, I said, we had this one member, and said, his name is.
Benny Pepperton.
So we really cool. He told me a long time ago. He said, "Bro, I was in a room with all my friends," and he said, "I was listening to the record." And he said, "By the name of."
Okay.
Yeah, I was petty those days. I was very petty.
Oh man! Oh, I can't believe that shit.
So you got the game?
Say it again.
Did you get the PS5?
I just opened it a second ago.
Is that
why
he sent you? So wait, Raphael, you sent him a PlayStation? Is that what's going on around here?
No, you don't want to answer that question, Raphael. You want to finish the interview and go in like, yeah. Anyway.
Oh, okay.
You're a gamer?
I am now. Yes. I was an ex-gamer, thought I got out the game, and then when I got this, my entire staff was like, yo, man, your life is about to change. I'm afraid.
Did you open it?
Is it in the box?
It's blacked out.
Yes, it is.
Can we see it? Can we see it?
Yeah, it's blacked out. My game company is called Ilphonic, and I've never really questioned me on Instagram and stuff. He was like, "What is this?" So I sent him a game to say, you know, so we got a game called Arcadegeddon. It's me and my engineer. We started a game company called Ilphonic, and Nas is one of my favorite MCs, so I called it Ilphonic after Illmatic.
Right.
And it's a guy named Steve Wedded.
How long have you been in this world, Raphael? Like the gaming world?
13 years. So my partner, Chuck Brungard, we started this game coming together because we were finding it hard in the music industry to, like, even we make records, like record industry people wouldn't even let us mix our own records for other people that we produce. Mm-hmm. And so I came up with another game, a game that we used to laugh about called Ghetto Golf, because they wouldn't let me in the fighting game on Russell Simmons' label. I knew I could never be on the game. It was an R&B. It was a rap game. So,
right.
We started this company back then, and we split up to start the game. He moved to Denver. We started at my studio, and like after 13 years, we did Predator, Friday the 13th, and doing really well. And then this is the first year I said something about it, because really in the gaming world, people don't really care about you being a musician. They just want to have fun. And, you know, video games is about gameplay. And one of our guys, Steve Wettman, is the visual guy who get all the styles of music, which is, the music is kind of based on, like, if it was a futuristic Dilla or 50 years from now, or like jungle funk. And it's a lot of different people who, a lot of different musicians who did. I didn't do any music in the game. Usually when I talk about the video game, people go, oh, you put music in the game? I'm like, no. I own a game company for the last 13 years.
You're a real game head that wanted to bring your
dreams to the forefront. Yeah, I just want to invest in it. I invested in it, and it's doing really well. And Quest is the first person that I actually sent a personalized, blacked out, Illphonic.
Souped up, yes. Everyone said you got the souped up version.
So it says Illphonic on there, huh?
Yeah, it's a multiplayer game. You could play it in a configuration of one on one. You could do either way, but it's a cooperative multiplayer game if you know anything about games. And we just really I just want to get into this world because I found it kind of hard being in the music industry. Industry's so clicky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Talk about
and like
it.
I said, I haven't had a go to person since Ed Eckstein. So I said, you know what? The way the music industry is now with streaming, you know, my music is not a game. And in games, they stream. So I figured I should get into something where streaming was going to be very popular. Games.
So how many games you got in game? Like, you can go, how many games you got out?
Friday the 13th, the last one in Predator. And we're working on Ghostbusters right now. And Arcade Geddon is out right now. It's in the Epic Store for, in 2022. It's going to be a lot more platforms than just PS5. But right now it's the Epic Store on PS5.
I was going to ask, what games do you play? Like, what's some of your games that you just play?
Gamer, I could play Call of Duty a little bit, a lot. But I'm really like a sports junkie. Like, I'm a state Madden, okay. And 2K. All stuff black people like to play. You know?
Nice.
Now, my son, he on 2K. He's got the new one. He been killing it.
What's he play? What's your son play?
He plays 2K. He's on 2K. I mean, he was, you know, like all the kids, he was on Fortnite, you know, heavy when that was popping. But he's more of a 2K guy. I'm more of a, I can do first person shooter, but I'm more so like, you know, Resident Evil, survival horror. I'm in the story type shit. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, That's what this is. Just check it out.
No, how y'all find time?
Yeah, I definitely will, man. Now, I got a PS5 too. I got a PS5, so
I want to say to Quest, man, congratulations on the documentary. I must have watched it like 7 times on my couch.
I hope he don't think he's about to leave, Amir. He think he's shutting down. Like, he think he's about to close.
I'm not shutting down. I just want to make sure that I said that, because when that comes up in my queue, like, I get chills.
Yeah.
Watching the Fifth Dimensions, I've never seen them move. So to watch it come to life and to know that happened and to know, like, I mean,
thank you, man.
People that didn't even know they were black. I mean, there's so much. Quest is always passing out history. Like, good.
I'm definitely using you for my next project because I'm doing Sly.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yes. You know what? She told me. His daughter told me.
Yep. I'm doing Sly. So.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I shall be calling you. What was the process? How was Lisa Bonet the deciding factor in directing the California video? Mm.
For It Never Rained, a lot of people turned in treatments. She had the best treatment, honestly, and we were always trying to be different. At the same time, we didn't want to out our the audience that we gained, right? But we felt like we could gain a new audience, and we could, you know, we felt like Lisa just, she had the edge. She had the edge on all the interior decorating that I like. Mm-hmm. She kind of gave me the apartment that I'd never had at that time.
Right.
You know?
So just at that time, I didn't know that she was heavily into directing videos or whatever. So she had like a rep that said like, I'm open for directing videos.
And, yeah, I guess she did. I don't think she did it too much.
I was about too to say, was there times. Another I think video?
She
just, yeah.
she was
I think she
do...
just liked the record and she just, offered a treatment, and we just chose her to direct.
I think Prince was about to hire for one of the songs on Diamonds and Pearls. I think like Walk, Don't Walk.
Okay.
Whether they shot it, I'm not certain, but I believe that she was. I don't think they shot it. You know, I mean, Prince is the kind of guy that will do a movie and then put it away for like 42 seconds, but you know. Yeah. Oh, my boy wanted me to ask you, how did you talk Don Cornelius into the house party video, which I think Don does a cameo. Don Cornelius has a cameo in the I Don't Know What You Come to Do house party.
I don't know. I don't think Don Cornelius didn't like me too much. I don't know.
Wait, what?
What you do? Oh. What you do to Don?
We love Don. I love Don. I mean, I used to watch. I watched. So I think I found out is that it wasn't that he didn't like me. I remember doing Soul Train one time, and I just remember all these girls, like, I call it halftime when everybody's taking a break. And, you know, First time doing Soul Train, you're like, oh, this is Soul Train. But then when I saw all the girls, like, feet hurting and eating Kentucky Fried Chicken at halftime, I was like, this shit is kind of cheesy a little bit, right? They like, that's what they feed them, KFC?
Yeah.
And then it was bad. No. And so, but then we was on there with New Edition. And a New Edition, like, they did one take. They looked at the monitor. They came back. They did it over. They did it over about four or five times until they liked it. And rest in peace, Lil Silas was at MCA Records at the time. Mm-hmm. And so when we got up there to do our performance, man, we performed once. And they were like, got it.
Right.
And I'm like, we don't get to look at the monitor?
Yeah.
Let's see if we like. But what I realized is that, you know, our label probably wasn't spending the sponsor money.
Right. Oh, nice way to phrase that.
You know? So we were pretty much a one and done. And when I found that out, I was kind of a little disheartening with, you know, the way that I was learning on the fly how the industry was. So
right.
So when I did get involved, I was done with Soul Train. So when I did get involved,
when they needed you.
Yeah, they wanted me to perform on Soul Train, and I was like, man, I'm not doing Soul Train. So
and that's Jamar Moore's Soul Train.
They begged me to do it, so I was like, I stood outside the Paramount until it was time for me to walk on stage. I didn't want to be in the dressing room. I stood outside. I walked in, and I performed, and I walked out. And then years later, I was at this street called Wineka. It's a little golf, a little driving range.
Right.
And I went to this little driving range just to hang out, hit some balls. And Don Cornelius was there, just hitting balls. And he just walked up to me, and we had an amazing conversation.
Mm. Really?
He was just giving me props and said, I'm watching you. I see what you're doing. And he did like me.
Yeah,
but I was young, and I was confused about the politics. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nobody was spending returns. No bread with him did at my label, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
That and Black Radio.
And it's diminished returns. You have dreams of like being on this legacy show, and then you get to see how the sausage is made, and it's not like how you think it is, and
that
it's
is disappointing. This business.
Yeah, you know, you could like, you know, like you mean to actually throw these sausages on the ground and kick them around and then put them in the bun?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I got to jump to Sons of Soul. So The first time that I didn't have an interaction with you. This is weird enough. We had an audition with Ed Eckstein, and we were going to sign to PolyGram. And I went to some dinner uptown. I forget where it was. You were also at this restaurant. And I can overhear your conversation. And you were talking about this tour. And you were telling the craziest stories I've ever heard in my life. Like, I would have think that you were talking about, like Hammer of the Gods era Led Zeppelin. And you weren't talking about, you were talking about touring with Janet Jackson.
Mm.
Now, without you burning bridges, from 1 to 10, and I'm not talking about the Tony side of things, from 1 to 10, how crazy was that Janet Jackson tour?
Because from 1 to 10, it was a 10.
That planted a lot of seeds in my head on like, those things can happen on the road.
Yeah, it was just, you know what? It's like, you know, we're like huge. I'm a Jackson 5 fan.
Right.
You know, so I grew up with the brothers, the first Black family of Soul, Maine, you know, right. I love Randy, love the Jackson. So just to get on the tour and learning tour, you just learn tour politics, right? And the tour politics were, I took two guys, they were just out of high school, really had nowhere to live. They were dancers. I took him on the tour. I met him in Sacramento. I just moved to San Francisco. This whole hip hop world in Sacramento that I found, and I used to play with him freestyle. You know, I used to play bass. What's this thing called 60 Seconds to Wreck? MCs come up. It was bass player and a drummer. And so I would meet all these MCs, and it was a couple of dancers who lived in my neighborhood. So I took them on the tour. And Janet people said it was conflicting with their show, with these two dancers that we had. Now, I think Janet had like 35, whatever, if you look at Pleasure Principle or whatever those mm-hmm. those videos when she has the whole Rhythm Nation.
Well, this is the third album.
Yeah, so they told us we had to like get rid of the dancers.
What?
Right. His name was Renee.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah, Renee Elizondo.
He kind of walked in and said, you know, Janet thinks it's in conflict with her. And I was like, man, look, we got two dancers. I'm leaving. I'm like, I'm not telling them kids they got to go home. These two kids are like 19 years old, 20,
right,
with no money. You know what I mean? They only had two suits to tour with.
Right.
I mean, and we had no lights on the stage or nothing. I mean, you couldn't even see us on that tour. I should tell people on the radio, if you want to see us, bring a flashlight.
So many lessons.
And then we never really met Janet, and she invited us on the tour. So I remember I came to the show once, and my whole band and the road crew was in this big line, and they by her room, and they were all walking to her room. She was at the front door shaking their hand. And I just was walking by, and I'm like, I'm not standing in the line to shake her hand.
Right.
Like, when you go on tour, you're supposed to, like, introduce, come say hi to the group.
Right.
And say, hey, you invited us. That was kind of that for me. And I think I was on a radio station, and I said, you know, from Oakland. So they asked me, how was it, you know, being, you know, meeting Jen? I was like, at this point, we've been on tour a long time. I said, I've never met her. But I think, you know, she probably the same girl from the good times, Penny.
Right.
So, you know, I had jokes.
Yeah.
But, you know, we love Janet, and I love Jimmy and Terry, and it was the tour support. We were only making like $3,000 a night. So right. We had to pay for our tour bus. And then what happened was Michael thing started happening. So some shows we would get to and the tours would be canceled. And instead of somebody calling us and saying the show is canceled, we would find out like the fans. So we still had to pay the crew, the buses. And it happened like 3 or 4 times. I think she was kind of helping Michael move around, which we understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know, so she couldn't tell us.
Right.
So, but I said, if it happens again, I'm going home. So I left in Philly. The night it got canceled in Philly?
Yes. Well,
that was my last night. I went to I told the bus to take me to the airport. And then they hired Mint Condition.
Yeah. A nice parallel move, though. Okay.
That is so... Okay. They did a makeup show. I was going to ask you, they did a makeup show, and you guys weren't the opener, and I was so disappointed and wanted to know what happened.
Yeah, that's what happened.
So needless to say, you are the best person to tour with because you know what the worst is like.
You know what the worst is like? I treat people tour with us. I mean, I treat people like kings because the first tour that Tony's ever did was really with the Red Rocks. We opened up for Earth, Wind, and Fire when Maurice White was in the group.
Mm. Right.
And they wanted a band that was more of like a trad day band because since we had to set up, we couldn't do as many shows with Earth, Wind, and Fire. But when we did play with them, Maurice White brought us to the back of the room and said, hey, I love you guys. Whatever you need, you can have. Ask for it. You got it. However much time you need. Got it. And that's how we treated people. When we, I think Joe opened up for us and my tour manager was, get off the stage, blah, blah. I walked in and saw that. I walked right in the middle of them and said, Joe, take as much time as you want. We'll be in the dressing room. When you're done, you come tell us.
Wow.
And so, yeah. So, I mean, we used to tour with Bobby Brown. Bobby Brown used to just unplug our instruments.
Well.
What? What?
I love Bobby to this day. I see Bobby. We like this, but Bobby used to come and be just like, and just take the big socket and just unplug, and we up there just maybe like, da, 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 da.
Damn.
But that was like how tour was. Tour was like, R&B was kind of gangster back in the day.
Wow. That's what it
sounded
like.
Okay, I will say for me, Sons of Soul, like every person, every musician has like that one album that's like their saving grace, their zen sort of thing. And, you know, this is during the time in which like we were searching for a deal. I mean, we were traveling like the Flintstones inside of a beat up $200 station wagon with no floorboard in the back. Like we have to elevate our feet in the air to not hit the ground, like traveling like the Middle Passage and like, you know, just that whole period of like, will we get a deal? Will we not get a deal? And living in poverty and all that. And like, just listening to that record, like, man, one day I'm going to play music like this in front of audiences. And like, I don't know, like Sons of Soul wound up being that record for me.
Yeah, for a lot of people. For a lot of people.
Yeah, that was the one for me too.
Yeah. And I'm about to say for all of us.
And I know that your relationship with Shahid really solidified with that record, assuming that he assisted on drums on like Tony's in the Wrong Key and all that stuff. I mean, the drums are definitely bombastic and loud like that. Just during that time period, how are you guys connecting as a group? Like, how are decisions made? How are, you know, is it every man gets an equal vote or that sort of thing? Or is it like you starting to see the kind of seam starting to break?
Well, I don't think, I think we were like so happy to be on. I think my brother, Dwayne, is more of the person who was in search of a deal more than any of us. He was a couple of years older. But once we got in, you know, Dwayne was this party time and I was more in a state of mind, like we could fall off. This is not promised to us. And I was just looking at things that I liked. I think I became pretty much the person that was steering the boat, but I had a wall of people behind me that was very talented. I always felt like if, you know, you're the best person in the room, then you're in the wrong room. And I had a lot of great musicians around me that could, you know, do the things that I needed to do to make the records that I wanted to make. Now, did I know that people was going to like those records? Mm-hmm. No, I didn't have a clue about record sales or number one. I never cared about Billboard. I never looked at Billboard for a number one record. I was really trying to impress the people before me. I just really wanted, you know, hip hop artists. I was really big on making hip hop people like my records. Nah, because all the records I hear is like, we don't like R&B. I was like, oh, you gonna like this R&B? I had a chip on my shoulder about that,
dude.
And
that's Fun exactly was my joint on that record. It was just the breakbeat Fun. That was my one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was gonna say that. Yeah, like I was definitely anti R&B in '92. Like I just thought it was like watered down and corny.
I understood why.
And yeah. I heard it, and it, you know, first I was like, front, like, Tony got a record, like, whatever.
Right.
And I heard it, and I was like, wait a minute. Like, there's breakbeats and things that I like. Like, if A Tribe Called Quest made music, this is what it would be. And
oh, yeah, and that's deep because
and
y'all,
for me,
yeah,
it's like the beginning seeds of
the movement.
And that's the thing. I want to ask you, were you aware what the state of emergency was for the black band? Because technically, Tony is probably either the last pure soul group, you know, and it's weird you mentioned Chambers Brothers because I was trying to find a band that was self-contained, not led by someone, not Sly and the Family Stone, not James Brown the Famous.
Mint Condition.
But, okay, Mint. What?
But they came after.
Yeah. Okay, so the last batch between Mint Condition and Tony, like you guys are the last. It's endangered species. Were you guys even aware that there was, like, you guys were about to be a novelty? I mean, 10 years later, even the idea of groups being together would be a thing, like to even collaborate with people in a unit. Were you even aware at the time that time was running out for the black band?
I don't think we were aware of it. I think we were so blinded by what happened before us, and we were so stuck in the past and living in the future at the same time because we loved hip hop. We loved what was going on, but we always thought we were a part of. I always thought I could be a part of it. Like when I got to New York and I saw Rakim walking down the street, or I was sitting in a limo or something getting ready to do an in-store. I see Eric being Rakim with a crew with Dapper Dan sweatsuits on. And bro, I was just sitting there like, what? So as soon as I got to New York, man, I broke free to every studio and found everything I wanted to find. As far as, you know, Tribe and Bob Powers and different people, different outboard gear for studios, different, you know, Neves and.
And you weren't, were you saying, like, was the rest of your band sort of on line with you? Like, yo, we need to sound progressive like these people.
No, it was just me. Yeah. they'll tell you that too. But everybody played a good part. Like Timothy Riley, Christian Riley is like Sly on the organ on the B3.
Right.
Mm. He's a drummer, but he's a great organ player. So where he was at, he wanted to be there. You know, where Dwayne was at, Dwayne was like a guy who played football his whole life and was in shape. And then when football was over, he was like, I'm not working out no more.
Right.
So once we got on, Dwayne was like, we on. You know, that's it. And I was like, man, I don't know if we on really. Mm-hmm. I've seen too many groups. When I go to record stores and I'm going through vinyl and all these groups that I seen that we don't know about, we never heard of. I wasn't
they
really trying
they was
to
on
be
too, at some point.
They thought they were on too. So I was more like, I knew it was a novelty, but just because of the tours that we had to go on, there was no space. I remember Salt and Pepper wanted us to, we toured with MC Hammer, Candyman, NWA.
Wow.
And I remember Salt and Pepper was like, kick the Tonys off the tour. They got a band. The set change is too long. You know what I mean? Mm. They wasn't like being nasty towards us, but the set change had to be, they didn't like that set change. Mm-hmm. And the only reason why we stayed on that tour is because Hammer kept us on the tour.
Oakland.
Can I ask y'all a question, since this is a rare moment, especially with you, Amir, and Raphael on the line? Because I'm translating, and I always thought in my mind, and now that you've clarified that you were such a hip-hop head and you had to be there, this is the pivotal start, Amir, right, of what we would call, neo-soul. I just want to say it out loud. Because
nobody
in my
wants
mind,
to claim
Raphael
the title,
has
but
always been the father of that.
And I hate the term neo-soul.
Everybody hates it. Like, but y'all got to give us another. What, give me the, y'all, everybody hate it, but what's the replacement?
Everyone hates the title, but it's like, it's the shortest way to describe.
Yeah,
you guys definitely started something new.
Okay, so I'm going to kill it. I've grown past it. I'm not like I used to be about the word.
Okay.
But let me tell you why I say it. Why I was saying it back then. I did this album called Ray Ray. And on the back, I had a tombstone that says, Neo Soul, rest in peace. Right? So I was all about that. So my thing was, like hip hop was a fresh, great brand, a great idea. Mm-hmm. Neo Soul was more of a budget that Kedar Massenburg kind of came up with for Erykah Badu and everybody.
I never thought about it like
and
that.
And it was like a way to go to a marketing meeting and say, this group is not the Temptations or the Sly them. It's like new soul. It's neo. So when you go to a meeting, instead of explaining they're not going to sell a million, they might do anywhere from 2 to 3. You just say, for short, neo soul. It had nothing to do about the feeling of the music like hip hop.
But you do know to the fans, it actually, so it might have started that way, but then it kind of matriculated to fans, to something else, to just something that they could say, that's what it is. So can I ask
you? It's an identifier.
Right. So for what would you have, would you have called it? Because you, it's your shit. So what would you have called it?
I mean,
call it good music.
It was a movement though.
When I did Instant Vintage, I was, you know, I was striking a different thing, a couple things that didn't really stick, but I was trying. And I came out with Gospeldelic for me, for my own sound. Gospel-delic, man. Gospel-delic. It's gospel-delic, okay. Means there's some truth to it, and there's the funk and the psychedelic in what I do. So okay. I call my music gospel-delic. There's some truth, there's some funk, psychedelic. That's what I called it. Anything but that. But
you should have like said that 20 years ago, we would have been calling it gospel-delic.
Yeah, but no, but honestly, look, I understand any group that was under it. I understand because it was a budget and everybody was getting on. It was a deal. It was money behind it. So there's nothing really wrong with it. It just, to me, it's a whack-ass name.
It was a whack name, but it was a beautiful movement. It's a whack name, though.
No. I mean, great groups came out of it, but none of those artists, I feel like it gave everybody a clock. But in hip-hop, it's forever.
No, it's not. Backpacker hip-hop. Sonny Sue.
It's forever.
Okay.
It's forever.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, the reason why I don't, it's so weird, especially with Neo Soul. It's just that everyone in that category was hell-bent on making sure that you knew they're not in that category.
Right.
And then it just became funny to me because the thing is—
See, like, I didn't know that. I thought I was the only one.
No, nobody wants to say the word.
Nobody under, quote, our umbrella wants to claim it. I mean, yes, I think Kedar, what do you call it, copywriting the word— Like it ended, and I told him this. I was like, "You ended the genre when you made it public that you copywrote the word." Like, who's gonna like? You just ended your own movement. The thing is like, as a guy who shops at Amoeba or Rasputin's or Jerry's Records, you know, I want to know where's the quickest what, like find, like it's an identifier for me, so I know exactly what section to go to, so I can buy the record I want to and not have to scrounge through 300,000 records. But I mean, I digress. Like, I definitely feel as though you guys were a part of something. And, you know, this is not only for this genre. I remember when Luther and Anita were scoffing at Nelson George's description where he called it Retro Nouveau. So,
I didn't know.
And, you know, it's just hard to categorize something or give an opinion on something until like 20 years has passed. But, you know, especially now that 30 years has passed since that movement. It's and I'm just lazier.
30 years? What? Okay.
Well, yeah. You know,
I kind of like to say too, like if you listen to all music, right?
30 years ago. So.
Yeah. 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 I mean, when you look at music, like I look at all music like this. If it's early country music, like blues, early Muddy Waters, and you can go back before people was making records to be for Sonny Hopkins, before you can go back to when they was making records in the field in the country all the way till now, to black music is one music to me. You have to categorize it to make money, to put it in categorize it to categories to differentiate to make money, but really it's all one. It's all one music. It's because black people are so creative.
But it's all our music. We
basketball, we got a crossover. We do all these different things so good. So that's when you listen to music like trap. Now trap is trap. Now you got drill.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, I feel like it's all one thing. Like when hip hop came out, I always wanted to see hip hop get old. I always wanted to see the last, like, the tribe, the generation before that, I wanted to know how they were going to react as older men, because I got a chance to see the Temptations and the Shalimars and the Whispers get old.
React.
And how do they...
Right.
I always wanted to see how the coolest cats in the world, hip-hop was the coolest. We don't like R&B. I want to see what they were going to be like as older men. And it's so funny to watch when you see like hip-hop cats like talking about trap artists.
Right.
That would have been the way the Whispers would have been talking
about them.
Somebody rapping like, what the hell are they talking about? I don't know. Blah, blah, blah. Now you hear artists, hip-hop artists saying that about trap artists. And it's just because now our generation is at PTA meetings.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. And let me just say this too, as a former black radio person, you should know that Neo Soul to a lot of people was rebellious music, and especially to black radio people, because this was music that we weren't necessarily allowed to play. Literally, Raphael, I plan to tell you the story about how I got fired for interviewing you live on the radio. And I think that a lot of times, y'all,
that's right.
Yes, y'all don't know.
You did get fired for interviewing Raphael Sadiq.
I told you some money.
Huh?
That's what brought her here.
It was my pleasure. It was my pleasure, but understand that, like, people like myself, Tiffany Bacon, and like DJs around the country, we was fighting for this shit. When they said to me, yo, I'm real quick, Raphael, they said to me, Raphael Sadiq is doing our music conference, and we want you to interview him and tape it, and we're going to play it back after we start playing his record, right? But this was during a time when you put out the record that was kind of Stax inspired, right? And I'm on the hip hop stage.
The
way I see it.
Okay. Right. So I'm like,
what city was this?
This is Philadelphia. I know you remember because I was drilling you about Josh Stone and stuff. We had a good time. So what's funny is when they said that they was going to play this shit back, I was like, that's a lie because y'all not going to never play no songs from this record because it don't fit our format. Right. So when you walked into the studio live, I was like, this is fucking Raphael Sadiq, the father of this fucking shit that is the hype. This is the reason that Philadelphia is doing what it's doing right now. How would I be like to sit here and lie and do a fake interview with this person? So we went up live. And a week later, was like, you disobeyed what I did, which we told you to do. And you got to, that was part of the story. So
another funny story about that record. When I went to this radio station in South Carolina, and so the radio guy at the time, the regional guy was in Atlanta. So he took me in this radio station. So my whole radio promo was a fake out.
Yeah.
With Columbia. Mm. It was all fake out.
I believe it.
But they had to take me because of the respect for the records that I was producing. They didn't just want to let me go. So they took me on this fake radio run that I was doing interviews, but nobody was at the label cared about the records. So they did tell me, some of the guys at Columbia told me, just get this record away because streaming was about to happen. And they were spending money on records and records weren't selling.
Right.
So they were confused because like Bruce Springsteen wasn't selling. None of the records was selling because it was streaming, right? So I get in the car with this guy and he said, man, your record is actually where they're spinning at. What the numbers were like was high on the record. So he said, between me and you, Columbia told me just to take this record out and tell him it's an experimental record and just play it real late at night. So like, but the record kind of caught fire, like Love That Girl, because people was like listening to it. And so what happened was Europe ended up calling France, actually. France called and Paris called and they called Stringer over in Columbia and they said, I don't know about in the States, but this is a real record over here. And so that's when I started playing in front of like 15,000 people by myself in Europe, different venues. But yeah, the whole record was like a fake out.
Yeah, they even had you come to the conference.
It ended up being one of my biggest records.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's dope. I'm glad it worked out.
That's funny. I remember that.
Wait. All right. Things are coming back to me now that I know I'll never get to ask you again. I got to go back to Sons of Soul for this one question.
Sure.
All right. So you worked with a guy who I had hope for to be the future, and it's not who you think I'm talking about. You work with director Sanji, and this is hot off his Pass Me By success. Like black videos. We never seen somebody with like Spike Jonze's aesthetic for black videos. But dog, the pillow video.
Lady.
How did homie talk y'all into doing that video naked?
Well, that wasn't Sanji. That wasn't Sanji. Sanji would have never did that.
If I Had No Loot and Leaving, I thought he did all three of your videos. Okay.
He wouldn't have never done that.
Who did that?
I don't know. And the people that's standing up, those are not us. That's not us. On the doubles that spinned around butt ass naked.
Have y'all seen the video for Lay Your Head on My Pillow?
Forgot. Yeah. That's why I'm like, I forgot.
They are 100% naked. Like this pre-Pornhub.
Trust me, everybody was drinking. So my brother's thing was this. This is all Dwayne. I'm not throwing him under the bus because
Yes, you are, Raphael.
Yes, you
are.
No, he stands by it. He stands by it. Trust me. My brother has no regrets about nothing he does.
I love it.
So you're trying to tell me that was a body double in the pillow video?
Oh, not in the part when the three dudes are standing together and they spin?
Yes.
And then when you watch them, they spin like really like, it looked real bad. So,
But MTV's showing the video and they clouded up all the private areas. So that's how like, It's like watching
So my brother walks in like we like the Red Hot Chili Peppers in his mind. So he's like, this could be like a real, like, this could be like one of those, what's the cartoon?
What?
The George Clinton, the tour bus?
Tales from the Tour Bus.
Yeah. This could be like the Tales of the Tour Bus, because, like, you know, when they show George Clinton just jump out naked?
Right.
So it's like my brother walked in the room, and my brother walks in the room and goes, hey, guess what, guys? We could be the first band to do a naked video. And I was like, what? Like, this is what I said. I said, well, if Tim is a square, was square this time, it's nerd, church boy, Church of God in Christ.
Ooh.
I said, if Tim agrees, I'll do it. There's no way in hell Tim is agreeing on this, right? We walk in the room and say, what do you think, Tim? Tim goes, let's do it.
Shit.
That's how that happened.
Wow, man. Okay. Man.
Yo, I had another Sons of Soul question. The interlude, don't be bashful, don't be shy, I'm only a single. Was that a real homeless Times guy, Square? Or was that, did y'all make that up?
Oh, no. We our engineer, Jerry Brown, took this recorder out in the middle of Manhattan and gave this guy some money, and he sang that. He brought it back. I was like, that's it. I rhyme, I rap, also a riddle. If it's in your heart, won't you give me a little? That's New York for you.
When you spoke of your engineer helping you develop, were you talking about Jerry?
Jerry Brown.
Is he still setting up Christmas lights in the studio? Y'all got to know, yo, Jerry Brown is the first black cat I've ever heard say, yeah, man, you just got to find your inner joy. And for me, every day is Christmas. And there's no, when we did What They Do, it was Christmas. And we did What They Do in like, we did it in May of 1996, and he had your studio looking like Christmas. And then when he was working with Alicia Keys, same thing. I walked in, saw his Christmas decorations. I was like, oh, Rafael Sadiq must be here because it's Christmas time, and Jerry came out. What is the deal with Jerry and his obsession with every day is Christmas to him?
You know what? I never knew that's what he was doing until you just said it.
But you didn't find it weird that your studio sessions are all Christmas lights?
Because the one thing I do remember about Jerry is this. You know, he's still around. You know, he makes a lot of John Legend. It's funny. He makes the John Legend Christmas album,
right.
Aw, so he's
when
still living
it.
When
I saw that, I asked John Legend, I'm like, yo, did Jerry have it? He's like, yes, he did.
Yeah. So the funny thing about Jerry, what I remember about Jerry the most is he talks about when Songs in the Key of Life came out. And he went and he stood in line at Tower Records on Sunset, this long line, and he bought that record, and he came home at Christmas Eve and he played that record.
Right.
So he has a thing about Christmas, you're right.
That is crazy. Wait.
Is that the same, is it Ollie and Jerry? Is it the same from Ollie and Jerry? It's not him.
No, Jerry mixed like the group called Climax. He worked with Climax back in the day.
That Jerry
used to be at a studio ABC. He worked at ABC back in the day as an engineer.
Okay.
Oh shit.
That's where he came up at.
Fonte, that Jerry is Jerry Knight,
was my bad. Yeah.
Jack and Jill, radio singer. Wait, speaking of ABC.
Is that the largest hit of Tony?
If I had no looters, the highest charting record. Yeah. But the biggest record to me is probably, it depends who you're talking to.
Just me and you.
Just Me and You is not a Tony's record, though.
Yeah.
That's my first solo record.
Okay. It's built. Okay, I see.
Only because Ed Eckstein wouldn't let me put my name on the record. So.
What?
Really?
So that record was just done in my, that's the record that was done in Sacramento in my mother's house in the room.
Okay.
On a T3, and I put it out. I gave it to John Singleton, and they Polygram. I shouldn't say Ed, but they said I couldn't use my name. So the second record I did was Ask of You, was on Higher Learning.
Right.
Higher Learning.
And they told me I couldn't use my name again, and I told John Singleton they couldn't use the song. And John called Polygram and said, "This record is going to say Rafael Sadiq." And so my first solo record would have been Just Me and You.
Okay.
And the funny thing about it is that's when I first figured out I had this patch called Jocko on the T3. Mm. I was like, I called my godfather, James Levi. I used to play with the drummer for with Herbie and the Headhunters. And I called him. I was like, who is that gave me a ride home and took his bass out and played for me when I was like 15? He was like,
oh, God.
That was Jocko.
Wow.
Wait, what?
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah,
wait,
Jocko.
What?
Wow.
Jocko played for me and my mom. I'm on Belvedere in Oakland. James Levi is my godfather. Paul Jackson, all those guys. The Whispers used to come and watch us play. And this band I was called Kick Band. And so I'm at the house one day, and James go, hey, man, give him a ride home and talk to him and open up his head. So we got this 450 SL convertible. We drive. He stopped by a phone booth, get on the phone. And he take me about 10 miles to my house. He pulls his bass out. He gets on the porch. He plays for me and my mom for like 30 minutes and talk to me and my mom, which my mom don't know. My mom wouldn't know who anybody is in R&B. All right, nobody. So jazz, she don't even know that. So he leaves. And then I'm in my house making this record when I made that record years later. And then once I make the record, years later, I call. I said, I seen this patch say Jocko. Now I know all about Jocko. I'm like, that? I called James. I said, who was that that gave me a ride home? Without blinking, he goes, who do you think it was? It was Jocko. Pistorius.
Oh, God.
Man.
Yo, how many other random stories do you have like that? Ladies and gentlemen, I know you hate when my voice comes on and tells you you got to come back next week, but you know good and well that we weren't going to give you the whole enchilada this one episode. So make sure you come back next week when Rafael Sadiq talks to, you know, Laia, Sugar Steve, and Fonticolo, and Pete Bill, myself, about his solo work, about touring, about songwriting, about movie scoring, about bacon. Yes, bacon. And he drops a really awesome exclusive gem. So next week, Questlove Supreme. I will see you guys there. Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.